Facebook reps and events.
Who is we, everybody?
The city, the...
Okay.
Well, welcome everybody to the Joint Committee on Transportation Preservation and Modernization. For the record, it is May 15th, 2007. And we're going to continue the saga tonight. Senator Boquist is going to take us away. And I would remind the committee that we've got originally planned tonight and Wednesday night to continue our discussions through the issues here. If we need more time than that, we'll take it. But hopefully we can get through it in time. Senator Boquist, you're on.
Okay, colleagues, you recall that we worked through the first set this evening. We're going to begin in congestion and freight mobility, the discussion we had there. However, prior to that, we have one alibi. In your packet in front of you should be a League of Oregon Cities letter. You will recall there were some questions at the last meeting that we had in regards to how the Small Cities program would work. So they have prepared a one-pager for you, and then in the back is the history. It is at your leisure. If you have questions, I can bring up someone from the league, or we can just move forward, and you can read the letter at your leisure. Any questions?
Anybody want to discuss this further, or you take it home, read it, and we could, if you need to, we could take it and discuss it on Wednesday night.
Okay, colleagues, you lost your chance. We're moving on. Time is important here. We're going to move into the congestion and freight mobility issues of the slides we have before. You'll recall, if you look up to the slide to my back, the freight mobility corridors and the areas that were identified previously that you've seen. I will note out here on this side, there's intermodal is one of the freight pieces out there, along with the Highway 20 upgrades in winter operations. And of course, there's intermodal over in the yellow area in the Central Valley that's over here. Those yellow slide or yellow areas that are up there, of course, represent, you know, congestion areas. However, first we're going to start out in the metro area. What we'll do is talk about the projects that were in that area that were discussed and get some feedback from you. You should have in front of you a white piece of paper that says congestion work group minus on it. This is just a refresher for you. It's dated May 12, 2017, and it has the list of projects on it. It says joint data set. And I want to bring that to your attention so you can see it. It's just sometimes hard to see the slides that are up there. The congestion work group had previously come forth and identified as the number one congestion priority in the state at the time as the Rose Quarter section, and that's, of course, in Portland right up here. I think most of you will recognize that area that's up there. And basically, that is a widening of the area around the Rose Quarter. That's on the sheet of paper you have. The next project down, they're not necessarily in priority order, but came out, are the Abernathy Bridge and the I-205 widening, which the Abernathy Bridge, if you don't know what that is, it's the Oregon City Bridge. That's the bridge that goes out on 205 and swings out there. And you're zipping along, coming in from the south, and suddenly you go to a parking lot so you can look down at the river on your right-hand side and watch the boats go by while you're sitting there. That's the Abernathy Bridge. And then the widening is that section from the I-5 corridor, the I-5-205 junction, this section right here.
Brian, you might add, too, that part of the thing with Abernathy is, besides just widening it, it would strengthen the bridge for right. Seismic. It's pretty vulnerable right now.
And colleagues, if you look at that, if you look at your lids, it's actually two separate projects. There, one is the I-205 Abernathy Bridge widening and seismic retrofits, and then it's the actual I-205 widening. On the west side is the two separate projects, 217 northbound and 217 southbound. I'm going to come back to those to talk about it. And then on your sheet of paper, you'll see a couple other things. It says active traffic management and I-205 bottleneck. If you look at the active traffic management, there are some areas in the active traffic management there, which in fact are those signage and flow-throughs and trying to increase it, versus the bottlenecks, which are actually some construction ramp work and some edging ramp work along the side that's there.
Yep.
Okay. Having said that, I'm going to go on to the list and talk about them just briefly and then get some feedback from you. Again, what we discussed and listened and looked across the entire state, is the work group had come to the conclusion that trucks from Representative Bence's district going into Portland, trucks coming from Representative Olson's district and elsewhere in, everybody has the same problem of trying to get through Portland. And so that was the priority of first the Rose Corridor and those other projects. You will note on the course of action slide on the right-hand side up here, which we'll discuss in a little bit here, is the Portland area had agreed that they would consider funding half of these projects out of their tax base if the state ponied up and funded half of it out of the statewide tax base. But having said that, you have the list of projects before you up there, and I think what we want to do is at least get some feedback, some buy-in, because these will be mentioned by name in a four-corner document that we draft.
Senator, it might be worth mentioning that each of these projects is on a state highway.
Absolutely. Each is on a state highway. Two of them, the I-205 and 405, of course, are freeways, which fall into the federal, broader federal definition, which we'll cover in a little bit. And you also recall that up on OLIS is the detail. There's detailed information on each of these projects. And I see Senator Johnson.
My question is mostly, I think, to reinforce the agreement that I think we had in congestion. But I want to make sure that there's absolute clarity about it. In two meetings that I had with folks from Metro, one of them, and another one in our congestion meeting, there were massive lists of projects. And I want to make sure that we're all in agreement that these are the projects that are going forward. And what I'm trying to inoculate against is project metastasis, because there were millions of dollars on those project lists. And I just want to make sure that we're clear about what the scope of what we're doing is.
Well, Madam Senator, that's why we're sitting in this room this evening at 5:30.
Cool. So I laid that question.
Caucus is meeting elsewhere, and we're here. This is the list that we have right now. It's the list the work group put forward. There isn't, as in the congestion work, as far as being named and funded, this is the primary list right here. We're going to see a secondary list later on, which is potential projects in the future to come back to, through OTC, back to the legislature. But this is the list of construction or congestion courses of action right now.
Representative Bence and then Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator, the question, of course, that we were asked, or all of us ask, is why this list, and what hoops do people hop through to identify those as being the most important thing for this state? And again, we've had this conversation multiple times. Any reference to long-term plans or things of that nature would be welcome.
Well.
Or if there are.
Funny you should mention that, Representative Bence, because if you look at the slide I just put up right here that says identified congestion freight needs in Oregon, we actually did not develop this particular slide that's up here. This slide came from the governor's visioning panel. This slide came out of the transportation forum. This slide came out of the congestion and freight mobility task force for the state of Oregon. And there were tier one projects, tier two projects, and tier three projects that were presented to us. And if you go back to this slide right here, these are all tier one projects identified by task forces and work groups and the governor's visioning panel. And at least a large section of these, funny enough, should not surprise many of you, because if you were in the Gang of Eight, which I was not, you will recognize some of these, and you'll recognize some of these from discussions from 2 and 4 years ago.
Follow up. Uh-huh. Right, and your item number, well, let me back up. The fact that these have been called out, and even though there's really large sums of money up there, there's no guarantee that this would, in fact, none of us believe that this will solve our congestion problems. So there has to be more to the plan, and you have it on the chart. Are you going to reach that item number 7 later and explain how that leads us out of this congestion?
I'm going to reach item number 7 later. Item number 7, for those who look at it, is congestion pricing and pre-congestion tolling. And what the work group, just so you know, and there's another slide that we're going to talk about this in depth because this takes important feedback, is that we sort of determine, and everybody has said, you can't build your way out of this particular problem. You have to go to congestion, some sort of congestion pricing or congestion unit structure in which you start getting individuals moving using multiple times during the day instead of clogging it up at one time in the morning and one time in the evening. I will digress just slightly here because I actually worked in the state of Washington for a long time prior to 2007. And ironically, up there, the first steps that they did in Washington that we've not done here is in the state of Washington, they got all of the major corporations together in the Puget Sound area, everywhere from Olympia north, and they started establishing staggered business hours in the state for all major corporations and all public employees. So you had a typical public employee office in which you had 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and 8 o'clock starting times in those offices so that they started working in the business with the business community and establishing a staggering to reduce congestion first. Of course, as you all know, by 2007, that had not worked, and they moved to tolling and congestion pricing in the state of Washington. Long term, the issue, if you go back, and we'll just easily look at this slide right here, there is no circle around Portlandia. Some of us probably had been in government. Well, some of us might have been in government. I'll take that back. Looking at Senator Monroe, and he probably was an advocate back then and said, hey, has somebody thought about a Western circle? Because if you look to the west, there is no complete circle around here. And it's a little late to build that. And so what we're doing is we'll have to build to the east and expand the existing areas we have right now. But by no means can we build our way out, and by no means is this a perfect solution. And I would remind you that most of these projects that are on here, when we get to the timeline, some of them won't even be completed for 8 years. Let me say that again. Some of them won't even be completed for 8 years if we pass the package tomorrow.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Senator Byer. Senator Broquist, you partially answered it. So this, if these are mentioned in the bill, they anticipated that within the 10, if we're talking about the 10-year window, these would be the only projects that would be constructed during that time. That does not mean that some of these others on the list wouldn't start in the planning if there was money identified for them. But from a construction standpoint, that's it.
No, I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
What you have here is the congestion relief and freight mobility piece of this, in which these are the major and the largest projects that are out there. I think you still have smaller projects that are out there that are in the normal STIP process, and you have projects in which the additional funding, both at city, county, and the state level, will provide opportunities for smaller projects that are out there for smaller areas. A good example, if you, I'll drop down and if I can find it right here, secondary projects are right here. And this slide, if you drop down in your sheet of paper, you say possible future projects. Some of these are smaller projects. The plan is to begin planning and executing the initial joint set of projects, those that are up at the top, that's the Rose Quarter, Abernathy, Freeway Widening 217. And then once we start getting those down and the final financing package is those in place, there'll be additional funds available both through the gas tax and an excise tax, at which then we can start moving into the additional projects. And again, the second set of data, which is this data right here, possible secondary, will be named projects in the bill is the idea, but they won't be approved. They'll have to come back with their match or how they intend to help pay for it, and they would go through the OTC process with input from cities and counties and then progress forward along that line. But I would say, in addition to that, there are still the normal STIP projects and smaller projects out there, and then we got multimodal projects that are out there, so on and so forth. So it's not true that these are the only one, but these are the only major projects. Virtually none of the other projects out there are run to the tune of $450 million.
Thank you.
Okay. Going backwards here, finally. If you, and I'd say since there's no more comments, I would assume at this point everybody's comfortable, at least for the four corners of this list of projects that's up here for the beginning. And we're going to come back to some of them in a bit more in detail. Moving on, I just want to refresh your memory. This slide is hard to see, but you have an 8.5 by 14 in front of you. That 8.5 by 14 actually says course of action number 2. One reason it says that, even though we're not doing courses of action anymore, is that's the reference point backwards. And the important part that I want to point out on that slide are these year marks that are right here. these year lines, this is 2018, 2019 going across, is we will ask that the drafter, when they put in, they identify those date time groups when the project is supposed to commence. And one of the important parts of that, and I'll bring this point up right now, is that we heard from the McKinsey report and we heard from our own Joint Ways and Means that some of these smaller projects, some like Representative Lively just referenced, need to be paid for by cash instead of bonding everything. And so having those on a date time frame and sequenced as are on your chart before you then allows us to utilize cash instead of complete bonding. The other issue is by phasing them out long term, that's in there for your comment, is instead of being this big, huge buildup, everybody and their third cousin brings their company to Oregon for 3 years and then leaves, is it was tried to design this of what our organic capability was in Oregon and the neighboring states to be able to build these types of projects, i.e. local economic development, which is most important to many of your members, ensuring that there's enough capacity within our own system and at least within our neighbor's system to be able to move these projects forward. So you can see that the time frame that will go across and will be in the draft of the bill, and you'll be able to read it. No further comments. The question that was raised by Representative Bentz was the issue of congestion, pre-congestion construction tolling, and congestion pricing. There is a difference between these two topics, and I need to point them out to you so you understand. As we said, we can't tax our way out of congestion. The other problem that we face is that in pre-construction tolling, you can only in the federal law toll certain areas. You have a toll sheet that's in front of you, looks like this, it's color-coded so that you have it. In general, without going through each of the specific projects, I just want to talk, give you a couple examples. You'll see Rose Quarter, which is right down here, Rose Quarter, partial of all the question in the Rose Quarter. The issue with the Rose Quarter is on a federal interstate. Okay, that's the first issue. And generally speaking, on the federal interstate, you cannot toll existing lanes. Okay, if you have free lanes that are there, they have to remain free lanes, but you can toll if you add an additional lane. In addition to that, the next restriction is that is on there, even in congestion pricing, which we're going to talk about in a minute, if you were to go into those lanes and do congestion pricing, that means congestion pricing is you're trying to regulate the flow, but you can't raise construction dollars. So each of the projects you see up here, Rose Quarter, Partial R, I-5-205, or Abernathy Bridge, you cannot restrict the freeway portions of that and charge for it. What I'm saying is for example, on Interstate 5, you can do congestion pricing, which allows you to help regulate the flow, to spread people over a longer period of time and try and develop habits so people go to work earlier, or go to work later, they go to Pearl District earlier, or they go somewhere or out to Swan Island later. You can do that with congestion pricing, but it's not a revenue generator to do your actual construction. And free lanes that exist today have to remain free lanes on the interstate. That said, the additional lane that you have, and if you look at Rose Quarter, and I want to go back to this slide because this is important discussion for you. If you look at Rose Quarter, which is, you can see the slide right up here is Rose Quarter. I think most of you cannot see on here, but you can imagine you have 405 going around this direction too. So the issue that you have is that when you toll a particular area, There are other streets and other paths that cars can go on to avoid your tolling. In the CRC, those three magic words we don't like to discuss here, but in the CRC, when they did the investment grade studies out there, they were able to identify where that leakage goes to. And so the important part of the slide, this slide right here that I was talking about, is in order to gain the maximum amount if you were to toll or to do congestion pricing, you would need to do that tolling and congestion pricing on both Interstate 5 and I-205 simultaneously. Here lies the problem. If you think about 205 or I-5 and the Rose Quarter area, most of you know that area, that means you only have one lane that you could toll unless you got a federal waiver, and so far we've not seen a lot of indication we could get a federal waiver. Your amount of revenue is not going to raise you enough revenue by itself to pay for the Rose Quarter construction. Now, if we got a waiver in the future, that might be a possibility. And there's individuals that suggest that maybe we could get it. I mean, I just sent another email and another discussion, and then the discussion is ongoing with the federal government right now in terms of your ability to do that. However, if you think it once again, a bridge, you can replace it. Under federal law, you can use tolling, even 100% of the bridge, to toll 100% of a bridge to do its replacement until such time you pay for it. When you do pre-construction tolling and tolling to pay for something, in the federal highway system, what happens is once you've paid for it, you must remove the tolling. Yep. So, in short, what you're up there looking at these two projects that you've seen right here, the Rose Quarter and the Abernathy 205, one of them 205, Abernathy Bridge, all indications are if we did not fund it, just to be honest, if we didn't fund it with a project money from an excise tax or gas tax money, in all likelihood, you could probably build that bridge in pure tolling money. And so you wouldn't have to use public dollars to do it. I think everybody needs to understand that. We're not suggesting that, but in a default position, if we didn't have the money, that is a possibility. Whereas on the Rose Quarter side, it's a little bit more problematic out there. But what the state treasurer has told our work group, and I'm conveying to you, is if you don't do some form of congestion pricing or tolling on both of those avenues in this whole structure right here around both sides, the leakage goes out and you can't generate enough revenue. So the second slide that's up here is simply congestion relief. And if you'll notice right there, I mean, the areas on our maps show that the congestion is from basically south of Portland in the vicinity of Interstate 205 and I-5, and it goes all the way to the river on both sides. Representative Bentz made mention that what we had proposed out of the congestion work group, and you'll see on the list that you have, is to prepare ourselves to do congestion pricing or tolling. We presently have no mechanism to do that. The old days up at Hood River, where the nice lady stands there with her cup out the window and takes your 75 cents, or down there at Astoria, are now long gone. That is not an efficient way to toll. And so what happens is you have to have a whole computerized back room, a whole computer setup, and then you have to have a front office for which to operate your tolling out of. There is online from our last meeting, actually was put up a series of tolling presentations that came from the state of Washington. The key point here is what we had proposed was to be able to set that up. And when we say set that up, the discussions we have encouraged ODOT to do to date is to work with WSDOT across the river, because they already have tolling. They started in 2007. They have an entire computer system. They're upgrading it as we speak right now. And it's not necessarily in our best interest to go build an independent system, because unfortunately, as much as I don't want to say this, we at some point are have to figure out how to get across the river again. And that means we would have to have an integrated system with Oregon and Washington. And since they already have a system, there is absolutely no reason we can't work with the state of Washington, and in fact, even potentially contract with them and their contractors to build the back room for a congestion pricing and a tolling system. Our front room, which would be external, that's where do you go buy a little $5 pass or a $10 pass or a $15 pass, could in fact be done by DMV. We discussed that before, because we have a government-run DMV and the state of Washington does not. So back to Representative Bentz's question, what we're trying to do is set up that mechanism up front, because one of the problems is we have learned, let's say hypothetically we can, or we believe we can do the Rose Quarter, right down here. Let's say we can do the Rose Quarter. You actually go out for an investment grade study to determine how much money you can raise for the bonding houses just before you go to bond. This is the chicken and the egg problem, is we don't know how much money we could raise to do that. And the next thing is the ability to set up that system. We have no system set up right now. So if we went out on the street for any project that required tolling, other than a bridge across, I suppose, Astoria or someplace where you can stop everybody and take their 75 cents in the can as they go across in an automated facility, the rest of that, we simply don't have the front room and the back room. And so what we have proposed is set that system up for congestion pricing and pre-construction tolling in advance as we move forward simultaneously.
Senator.
Do we have any indication from ODOT's preliminary inquiries with the state of Washington about their willingness to provide these backroom services? What are the contract deliverables? What's the accountability and the oversight, and any estimate of the cost?
Yes and no. But you're going to get an answer anyway.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. We've had some initial conversations, and I think there's a willingness from our partners in the state of Washington to engage this discussion. I think Senator Boquist did mention there will, in time, be a need for interoperability between the two states. And so I've asked directly that conversation of my counterparts up in the state of Washington, and I think they're willing to engage the discussion. There are several other scenarios that we can look at as well. I think the Senator has broached some of those issues, whether it's a stand-up unit within the Department of Transportation using DMV as the front door, just because they're ubiquitous across the state. So there are several scenarios that we will explore. But to your question, we've engaged the conversation with WashDOT. They're willing to have a discussion, but they're in a process right now to actually upgrade and send out new contracts for their tolling discipline.
And to follow up on that, Senator and colleagues, so you know, is the $33 million that's on the slide up there that Representative Bentz mentioned, which is number 7 right there, that number came from a rough order of magnitude that we actually got in discussions with ODOT, with OTC. And just so you know, OTC has a consultant coming to it this week during their main meeting on this particular topic. And then in addition to that, in our discussions with the state of Washington, and just so I think there's at least 3 members up here that have been involved, of the committee that have been involved on the ongoing discussions with WashDOT, trying to determine what the feasibility is of going forward.
Matt, I would assume that there's quite a bit of cost efficiency there, since you would not have to duplicate the backroom operation that they already have, and essentially it's just putting the readers in place to read the license plates.
I think, Mr. Chairman, sure, there is the hard infrastructure and then the backroom conversation, and we would take care of the spade work that the state of Washington already had done in the agreement that we would work with those good folks.
Others, anything? Go ahead.
And I would just close this particular area with the primary purpose of this that we are looking at right now, because we're talking about using, you know, an excise tax and bonding, is in fact to set up the congestion relief portion. But the congestion relief portion, in terms of pricing lanes into the future for congestion relief, is the same exact that you would use in pre-construction tolling. So we're going to have to go down this road. Even if we don't use tolling as a mechanism to fund particular highways or bridges, we still need to have this in place. And I would point out, I was pretty surprised myself that, I mean, presently in Washington, what happens is you get something about the size of a small Band-Aid sticker that, you know, you put up on your your windshield, and it's in $5, $10, and $15 increments. So it's actually quite inexpensive compared to what we used to. And there's no such thing now as using toll booths or that sort of technology.
Representative Lively and Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Senator Beyer, Senator Boquist. So I assume in some point down the road, as we're having this conversation about this package, some will ask us, so how much relief are we getting for the amount of money we're investing? So help me understand, in those congestion projects, we have congestion there now. We're going to invest $1 billion and some dollars. So at the end of the 10-year cycle, how different is it going to be than it is today?
To answer your question, back in the original proposal that came forth, we actually had, it was monetized. And in fact, you can monetize the congestion relief, the wear and tear on the vehicles, the sitting of trucks. And then the second thing is you can look forward and determine with population growth. Now, it's interesting, I think Willamette Week, Nigel, my good friend at Willamette Week, had an article out there from one of the economists up in Portland. And his deal was, well, none of that makes any sense. And so what you do is you don't build. And then when everything turns to a parking lot, this is my interpretation, nobody will drive, so therefore you'll reduce your utilization. And hopefully the cars will go away, and then maybe the truckers will get their trucks through. The deal is don't build at all, don't expand at all. Our problem right now is, as Representative Lively, as you know, is it's a parking lot good portions of the day. And as we used the example before, just the ability to move trucks from my district in terms of crushed hay and the 30,000 trucks that go across the road. If you do go back to the slides from when the congestion, when we put ours up, and we could find them if you went to next meeting, they actually, it monetizes, it outlines it, so on and so forth. And I think probably the director could give you a couple of comments on that, too.
Yeah, if I may, Mr. Chairman and Representative Leinrad, the senator has done a very good job. We do have hours of delay. We will see a reduction. I think one of the other aspects that need to be mentioned, this is a comprehensive engagement. This was a discussion in the congestion work group that not only do you surgically strike at these big projects, and we will see hours of delay reduced here, but also remember we have conversations about pricing, which will help thin or blunt the congestion activities as well as investment in transit as well. So a comprehensive investment that deals with the friction that exists in the system and then allowing choice for individuals who might not need to take a car can take now a more enhanced version of transit, whether it's light rail or the bus service in the Portland metropolitan area. So a comprehensive investment to cover all the bases.
Representative Benz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Garrett, how would you respond to those who say this is just a scattershot approach and throwing a little money at one of the problems and is not a long-term plan? What would you participated in this congestion work group for the past 3 months. How would you respond to that assertion?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, I think it is a long-term game. We're in for the long game here. There are immediate investments that you need to make. There are longer-term, again, pricing conversations that we need to do a lot of spade work to inform, to get to a point, is it appropriate to do that? But I think overall, it doesn't go away. It is managing congestion, to be very honest with you. But it's a consistent investment across not only these projects, but again, given the size and scope, which will determine what this investment package is, there's a cascading effect of monies that come to the state of Oregon and our city and county representatives up in the Portland metro area that, again, will enhance and strengthen the transportation system, whether it's on the state system or the local grid system as well.
Follow up. Thank you. And I heard I drove to Ontario and back over the weekend and had lots of time to listen to Sirius Radio, and there was a long discussion about plans in Washington, D.C. To do something. This is something that I heard was $150 billion in tax credits and then $850 billion for a total of $1 trillion in P3s. The P3s that I studied when I was on the Public Infrastructure Commission all turned on tolling and other ways of raising money to pay the investors for that capital. Is that part of this package?
We have not had specific conversations with regard to the federal monies because it's, as of right now, just to be blunt, it's more rhetoric than real. Now, that may change. There may be something. It's a big week back in Washington, D.C., known as Infrastructure Week. So there may be more detail coming out of what a trillion-dollar package looks like for infrastructure. First and foremost, how do you define infrastructure? Because that's just not roads and bridges when they talk about a $200 billion investment with a five-time leverage with public-private partnership or public equity coming into it. So I think we need more detail to see what opportunities may exist here. I will tell you, and this is to a question that Representative Smith broached several meetings ago, what does it mean if we make an investment here in the state? How do we leverage federal dollars? And I think the reality is, if you put more skin in the game, we have seen we positioned ourselves better for discretionary types of money with the current Surface Transportation Act, the FAST Act. We've seen on the freight side, we have Fast Lane. That's a very competitive pot of money that, with money invested by the state of Oregon, we can put the match up to better position our projects here. The Tiger Grants, kind of a multimodal investment across all modes of transportation that comes at about a $500 million mark here. We can better match those types of investments. On the transit side, new starts, the light rail, small starts, rubber wheel tires. You have more money available as the kitty grows for both state and local government interests. I think the match interest that is always a challenge, or the match requirement, I should say, that is always a challenge, not only for the state, but for our city county partners. Again, we enhance that and their ability to seek federal monies, the Federal Land Access Program, or the safety-type programs that come from the from the federal government. So I think overall, to answer a legitimate question that Representative Smith put on the table, is the state of Oregon will be better positioned to compete for federal dollars if we make an investment here. We're still looking for what that federal opportunity looks for, to be very honest with you. One final thought. I hope it comes, because the clock is ticking on the current federal surface transportation bill, FAST Act. It expires the end of September of 2020. And you will recall they did some, let's just say, creative accounting. They have not fixed the misalignment with the Highway Trust Fund, where there is a misalignment of expenditure and revenue here. We have to get to the core issue to ensure that the monies that are in that trust fund, there are dollars that have been sent there, real dollars sent there, to cover the cost to deliver the programs across the nation and in the state of Oregon.
It's a polite way of saying they spent the money but didn't put any real money behind it, just did that. Representative Smith-Warner, and then Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for your ongoing work on this. I just wanted to mention two things briefly in this section. First of all, on the congestion pricing idea, I guess I wanted to point out my understanding from the work group conversation that we're not just saying, okay, on these three roads, that is what we are going to do. It's more, we are looking at this as part of our, because indeed we've been looking systemically at how we can manage congestion. So I guess I just wanted to convey my belief from the group that it's the idea of congestion pricing that we will look at, that we will try to maximize our ability to do that in a variety of ways as we work between the many and myriad, you know, complications that the feds put on that, and that we're not just saying, okay, on these three projects, we are going to do congestion pricing, but just the idea of congestion pricing overall in the region as one of our tools towards managing that congestion. Does that jibe with your understanding, Senator?
And exactly, and it follows up exactly what Representative Smith has continued to point out, is we need to position ourselves for future federal funding. And if you look at the entire map up there, that's the initial area of congestion pricing and consideration of what areas is OTC going to look at. And our important part is to jumpstart it. In order for us to get matching funds in the future, as has been pointed out by several individuals here, is we need to be prepared to do that. And if they come out and they want shovel-ready projects, and we don't have the ability to very quickly stand up the back room for tolling or congestion pricing and the front storefront of that, then we're going to be left in the cold. Now, we have already reached out. One of the states has pulled out of the pilot program across, two states pulled out of the pilot program across the United States. And this committee, the leadership here has already instructed, and OTC is already working with ODOT to go forward and make sure we get one of those slots. So once again, we're aligned, as Representative Smith has said, and he keeps prodding on properly, that we need to be aligned and in the positioning. So, for example, we said we don't know if you can do Rose Corridor and pay for it, but the only mechanism will be a federally approved exemption pilot project. And so if we're not in the queue now, and prepared when they make a decision at the September budget, because that's when they'll be doing it. In September, if it's not a continuing resolution. If we're not prepared now, we won't get it. We won't be there.
Great. And then my other brief thing, because I think we're moving on out of this chunk. In your presentation, in our conversation about the kind of the big congestion projects has been this whole 50-50, 50 from the metro area, 50 from the state. And again, talking about the system we're setting up for this pretty new idea of regional MPOs and their ability to do a split on that in the future. I just wanted to highlight my understanding that the idea behind that is for all of those regions to have a similar 50-50 split with the state.
That's correct, and we're going to cover that. We're not leaving that particular topic yet.
Because I saw 80% somewhere, and I was a little concerned / confused about what that was referring to.
We're not at the beer carcass, sorry.
Okay. Darn it.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Senator and Director, just A+ on this work. This is good stuff that you folks are doing. I appreciate it. Really quick, I want to do two things. One, get on the record. As I look on page 28 at the list of projects there, it'd be very easy for some, particularly on the east side of the state, to say, man, this is all about Portland. I couldn't be more wrong. When I look at that I-5 Rose Corridor upgrade and these improvements on 205, boy, that just helps our ports up and down the Columbia River, Port of Morrow, Port of Umatilla, the Development Authority going on up there. And so I really want to get on the record that I really support this effort. Two, and I'm a broken record. You guys led into it, but I'd already got on in the queue. I think this committee really needs to encourage the co-chairs and the governor and the rest to do everything we can to have professional staff back in D.C. representing the state of Oregon over the next 18 to 24 months, maybe even longer, to make sure we're picking up every opportunity that's possibly out there, especially as we're advancing this type of package. Because I really, as Director Garrett was pointing out, I really think we're going to have more of those opportunities coming. And I think it would be foolish of us not to invest a few dollars to make sure our collective voice is represented. And I know we've got members of Congress and all that, but we also know how Washington, D.C. works, and I think it'd be smart for us to have professional folks back there. One last thing. I have a 101 question. When I look at page 28, is the $1.1 billion the state's portion, or is that the total of the project? Total of the projects. Okay, thank you. And again, I compliment you guys on your work.
Representative McLean?
I just had a brief one. I don't want to be redundant. I agree with a lot that's just been said. But the one part that made me feel like I liked this portion of what I considered to be boldness was the fact that we have multiple tools here for long-term system building and long-term planning. And so even though you may not have everything ready to go at exactly the same time, you put into the queue all of the different type of creative, exciting, and important tools that we need to create that whole system. And I think we do that when you look at congestion pricing and tolling that's being done to make sure that we are trying to get really and truly the most out of the system we already have, but also potential for more, I would say, productivity out of the system to come. And then also the whole idea about behavior. They were telling us when we were looking at some of the Washington State items that people who could have 15 minutes taken off of their commute would pay $15 to get in that lane. And so I think it's important for us to realize that, again, it's a system we're building, not just a project, and that it's a multiple and really a very interesting and long-term approach that has not been tried before.
Senator? Senator Johnson?
Senator Boquist was going to respond.
Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to reiterate what Representative McLean is and go back to Representative Smith, because he correctly pointed out, if you remember your 8.5 by 14 sheet here, just so everybody remembers here, first off, it's a $1.1 billion investment over 10 years. You see, 10 years. This is not like next year we're going to spend it. It's over 10 years. And so when you take that down, and then the upper right-hand corner of that sheet, as was pointed out by Representative Smith, and thank you, is you see the state share of that is about $598 million, and the local MPO share is $525 million. This is a fundamental concept. We sort of have to agree tonight that we're going to go forward if we're going to do the planning, and that is that we have a local MPO, the Portland area MPO, saying they will pay half if we, the state, pay half. And the fundamental question for all of us is do we want to enter into an agreement with them in the future, potentially where they pay half and we pay half, and use that as the model going forward? Senator Johnson, question.
A couple of things. The first one is the two states that pulled out of the pilot project for tolling, were there lessons learned? Who were they?
My understanding, it went just North Carolina and Virginia, side by side, and they you know, because they're next to the Capitol, because they have staff that can go to Washington, D.C., as Representative Smith said, and when the food trough opened up for these, they grabbed a couple of those slots, and then my understanding is basically did nothing. Director Garrett, you have...
Now, Senator, I think you've hit it, but Senator Johnson, I would share with you some feedback that we have received. Is it difficult? It might be easier to work the mainstream tolling sections at the federal level than it is with these this pilot here. That's something we may learn as we try to position ourselves to secure potentially one of the two spots available.
A couple of follow-ups. Senator Boquist keeps making reference to this document, which I think is a very important document, and we all, on our little congestion, sat in the room when he went through the hydraulics of what sequencing do we have here. And this actually, I think, is more fine-tuned than people understand, that there's a certain hydraulic here about what roads can we tear up at what times and have serious work being done on them and still keep the economy moving. So my question is whether or not this group would want to entertain the idea of directing in the bill that planning in ODOT focuses on the deliverables here, perhaps to the exclusion of some of the other planning work that ODOT is currently doing. And I'm glad you're up there, Mr. Director, so you can comment on that. And the second thing is, in order to keep the hydraulic in this really very important sequencing document going, do we want to contemplate any kind of expedited permitting for any of these projects to actually get them out the door in the order that they are supposed to go in, so that we don't end up bollocksing up the whole system and paralyzing the metro area in the name of reduction of congestion?
I'll just comment briefly. We have one of our probably Wednesday night, where it goes, we're going to get to that exact issue in terms, and we talked about it in length in our work group, as Senator Johnson pointed out, is, you know, in order to stay on track, on time, on budget, we're going to have to do some review of some of those issues to move them quicker. And I believe Director Garrett, we actually discussed some of that, and I'll let him comment, where we said, you know, some of the expedited hearings, public input, so on and so forth, to stay on track.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, 2 points. With regard to focusing planning on these projects, we will mobilize and have the appropriate resources, both internal and external to the agency, to ensure that if indeed you animate this opportunity, that we will deliver on this opportunity.
With existing resources, Mr. Director,
I think it's important that depending on the size of the package and what comes out, there's going to take a resource to deliver the size needed here, and we're just going to have to again watch the numbers and bring forth what we think would be a legitimate roster to deliver. And then we can speak about what we would do in-house, what we would outsource as well. Those are legitimate scenarios that will play themselves out dependent on the size and scope of what may be produced by you and your colleagues here in the legislature. Collateral to that, I would not want to give short shrift to other planning activities for other projects across the state of Oregon here. So I think our attention will be solely focused on these, the big three as I refer to them, in an appropriate manner, but not to, again, dismiss or not focus the attention of ODOT planning professionals on ensuring that other projects across the state are receiving the appropriate.
If I could
approach.
Just follow up one more time. I too don't want to halt planning, but I think that it might be a worthwhile exercise to see what's in the planning queue. If you're planning, I can't even make up what it might be. There is prioritization of planning. What I'm advocating is we figure out what we want to accomplish, and it might mean that other activities wait their turn in the queue. I don't want to plus up your planning department, so it's have us do what we're doing now and give us some more money to do more. I'd like to see some internal prioritization by you or the professional staff, the OTC, that says maybe these activities can be put aside.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I think that's good counsel. I think that is legitimate discussion that we would put on the table to ensure that if we're going to ask for resources, you need to know where those resources are directed, and we would articulate and prioritize, just as you say. That's a healthy conversation.
Okay. And if you would allow me one more. Senator Boquist, I think, put the question before us, and that is the fundamental question that has to be answered. Do we want to incorporate in the bill the notion that we are going to partner with the MPOs to do the half and half? And my question would be, that's all well and good, but there are some unknowns. In fact, it's better than well and good. I think it's a great idea. But there are some unknowns. And the question that I think I would pose is, how do we calculate the risk factor of the MPOs being able to perform? It is asking their voters to undertake certain burdens. It is asking them to mount campaigns to educate and bring folks along. And I just don't know whether we've done the risk analysis to say, okay, we're entering into this partnership. I mean, it feels like a marriage. What happens when the divorce comes? How do we divide up what works here if, God forbid, for some reason, they are incapable or unwilling with changes of commissions to, what are you two yucking it up about?
I said you can have my kids.
No, the lawyer's going to keep you in the style to which you wish to become accustomed. My point, though, is how in any one of these kind of nouvelle partnerships do we assure performance? And if there isn't, is there a bag holder at the end of this? And you are talking to some of the bag holders sitting at this dais.
I think I can answer that in a couple of ways, because that's where we're moving to right now. And looking for a different slide here, and we'll just leave it on this slide right here for the moment. So, having said that, I'm going to use the whiteboard. So, the exact question that Senator Johnson is asking is that if we enter into an agreement with, in this case, Metro JPAC, for a better description, it's basically a new state MPO. It's slightly bigger than what Metro is right now. How that authority works and what they have asked for temporarily is that they would set up basically the board, and if you would actually be called, we'll just call it a state MPO for the moment, because legislative councils come up with just a placeholder name. This particular organization, how that would work, is for their 50%, let's talk about their 50% first, have asked to be able to implement a local gas tax of 3 cents, okay, three times, for a total of 9 cents spaced over time in order to pay for their half of the bonding, which is about $500 million. And then in addition to that, three times a $5 registration fee, three times. That funding source that they have would then pay for their bonding. And you have a financial from last Monday night. How this works and how it's proposed right now, so you all understand, is that we would give that local board the authority to implement that taxation at the board level. That would then become their base of funding for their share of these projects. That is referable, as people may have mentioned before. If they enter, they would give this authority immediately upon passage, and then they will be able to make the vote themselves to accept basically the offer to participate. That's on their side. If they were to implement that, and 2 years down the road, for example, as Senator Johnson has pointed out, the contractual bonding obligation would already be in place, and there are mechanisms to put in place, for example, unfortunately, if it was referred later on, in which the state itself would impose it to cover the contractual obligation for bonding. It is not much different as our ways and means people do now in terms of joint ventures, intergovernmental agreements along that line. So there are mechanisms in place to guarantee it. The other thing that we've asked is that somewhere between 120 to 150 days, the board will have the decision. So long before we ever impose a tax, long before they ever impose a tax, their board will have to agree that they're going to do this. And on our side, our funding position, in this case, it's the proposal in there is the vehicle privilege tax, that will be in place long before we ever spend any money. And then you enter into an intergovernmental agreement, and that contractual agreement then takes precedence over everything else. So there are mechanisms that you can put in place.
The important point, I think, to the senator's comment is that all happens fairly quickly if we pass the bill. We don't make any bonding decisions until after that's done. And if they choose not to go forward, the projects don't get done. Not because we're being vindictive, because we don't have the resource to do it.
Exactly.
Can one commission bind a future commission under this scenario?
As soon as the contractual obligation is signed, yes, they can. Because then it's a debt. It's just like contract law. And so it's the same thing on our side. When you enter into a bonding agreement, it would be no different than OCC suddenly deciding they're going to stop making payments on their bonds for the highway trust fund. No different than that. It's a contractual obligation. And so that's their half. And how that works is this, and this is the important part so you all understand, there have been two discussions on how this would happen. One is, do we, the legislature, impose the tax on them? If we were just to flat impose the tax on them, one, we don't know whether their board really agreed to it or not. That's the first issue. The second issue, though, is if it's a state-imposed tax, it goes inside the highway fund, and it is then divisible at 35% heavy and 65% light, which changes the entire dynamics out there. Because the problem with that is we've never had to collect it that way in a small geographic area. And we're not even sure how we would do that. And so presently, the plan that's been put forth is that we provide them the authority. That's, I will point, the most jurisdictions had that authority before. That's even been proposed in the same idea elsewhere on our side that you give OTC authority to do that. It's the same structural type authority. We give it to them. They impose it locally. Once we impose ours, then we enter into an intergovernmental agreement to proceed. Future-wise, just so you know, this is the same sort of scenario you would do with other MPOs or other counties for future matching projects in the future.
Probably the other reason you wouldn't want to do it, have the legislature do it, I believe, is if we imposed it and it was referred, it'd be a statewide vote rather than if we do it that way, it's a vote within the taxing district. The way to think of these, and it's built around the special districts legislation that already exists. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. So thank you for that explanation, Senator Boquist. So can you explain to me how, so if the whole, the gas tax statewide gets referred to the ballot, if that were to happen, and then at the local level, we could be having a whole ocean of ballot, I mean, how many ballot measures could we be possibly looking at across the state at the local level, and then what if it passed, for example, one passed in Multnomah, but not in Clackamas County?
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Okay. So let me go back here.
Okay.
It's a district.
It's a district.
So the district,
doing,
so there's no risk.
You created a special district, right? Basically, for a better word, I'll use this, it's metro on steroids, okay? And so you created that special district. That special district's board of director then imposed the tax on their members. It's not a vote of the people, okay?
And it cannot be referred.
No, it's referable. Anything in the special district is referable. So they would then have 90 days, generally speaking, to go collect it and refer it. Simultaneously, so if you want to get complex, you ask the question.
There's
they could be referred.
The required number of signatures.
The gas tax could be referred. The excise tax could be referred. And in theory, you could end up with three referrals, if not more, simultaneously in theory. But that is no different than what we face right now. No matter what we do, for those of you who are not on revenue, no matter what we do in the finance, as soon as it gets to 18 votes and 36, it is all referable across the state.
That's right.
And so no matter what we do, even if it's one penny or 29 cents, it's still referable.
Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, Senator, explain, you may have touched upon it, but explain what happens if none of what you just wrote up here happens, but the new car fee does pass. What happens to the money that begins to accumulate?
If on this side, if this did not pass at all, is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On the opposite side, which is our side, which we haven't got to, if you're doing an excise tax, and the excise tax is, which is referable to, just so everybody's very clear, if it's not referred, the excise tax, that money starts to go into an account, and then we would have our side, and they would not have their side. It would have to come back to the legislature or us to determine what to do next. Because that money, of course, they were entering into an agreement where we're only going to finance one half of it, and they're going to finance the other half of it. Either side fails, it ends up right back here in the February session. Let me make sure everybody understands that. All the timelines that will be put into this is what we've been discussing from our work group across it. All these decisions and referral windows all happen before we come back here next February. Every one of them, the opportunity to refer, all of that happens in that time frame. So if either side fails, you end up back into the legislature right now making a decision of what you're going to do next.
Follow up. Yeah, and in the event that there's not a referral, but there is a judicial challenge, what happens?
If you're talking specifically the excise tax,
I am.
Which we hadn't got into the excise tax yet. Let me walk into the excise tax first and then talk about the deal. On our side, what we've talked about is doing an excise or a privilege tax of 1% initially. if that is referable just like everything else, if it is referred and the excise tax is referred and the voters strike it down and we're not able to collect on our side, right, then we end up coming back to the legislature. The important part about the excise tax right now is there are several mechanisms you can do it. The reason the excise tax would be struck down, and the only reason, unless it was referred completely, we don't want to do it, is the legal challenge, as Representative Betts points out, on the excise tax, it is going to be an Article 9 challenge.
Yeah.
Everybody understand what Article 9 is? That means it's inside the highway fund or outside of the highway fund. And so if it is challenged and found to be inside the highway fund, the excise tax then becomes, once again, 65% light and 35% if we keep it in place. The problem with that is then you probably face another challenge. So it's going to be, the committee is going to have to determine if the excise tax is struck down on our side, do we want to retain it and then switch it over to 65-35 cost share between light and heavy, which is a substantial burden, or do we want to just automatically repeal it and start over again and come back in February? And the other thing with the excise tax is that it has, as with everything else, expedited flow to the Supreme Court so that you get a quick decision.
Can you follow up? Can you go back and explain to folks what you, when you say light and heavy, what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So there are two things right now, generally speaking. Article 9, just so you know, Article 9 of the Constitution is the highway fund.
Yep.
Article 9 has two components in it. One is everything that's vehicle gas related for motor vehicle fuels has to go into the highway fund. The excise tax is not. It's a privilege tax. However, under Article 9, if you collect any money under Article 9, it goes into, one, the highway fund. And this is really, the highway fund is kind of a misnomer. It's really not a fund, and the Constitution does not create a fund. What it really creates is you must spend it on highways. That's what the Constitution says. That cost responsibility, second half of Article 9 of the Constitution, says that 65% of it, and this changes, and what it basically says is the heavy trucks above 26,000 pounds, heavy transportation, and it breaks down, sorry, it doesn't say 26,000, but heavy trucks above 26,000, they have to pay their cost responsibility, and we, the lighter vehicles, less than 26,000 pounds, have to pay their cost responsibility. 65% are light vehicles, and we talked about this once before, which is basically 26,000 pounds and less.
Yeah. Cars,
and 35% of the cost responsibility is the heavy vehicles, and that's basically plus 20. So this is your trucks that you're talking about, normally speaking. Okay. And so that's the breakdown of what it is. And so if it's in the highway fund, it's a versus height, it's highway versus passenger cars, basically light versus heavy trucks. And this cost responsibility we do in a very complex formula that spends weeks and weeks and weeks of meetings every 2 years in order to come out of what is that cost responsibility, and we do it on a statewide basis. The problem with doing something like this, the 65-30 in some place like Metro, is if you are doing a, which the state could impose a tax in Metro area of, say, the gas tax, if we impose it, it has to fall under this formula right here. And we presently don't have a mechanism. Think about that. I mean, how are you going to figure out which trucks in Metro area have to pay their 35% versus the other ones? It becomes very, very complex and almost unmanageable to do it that way, which is why we talked about what happens is you probably repeal it and start over.
Follow up.
Now, just when you say repeal it, you mean repeal the excise tax.
Repeal the excise tax.
Thank you.
Exactly. Thank you, Senator. Fully respectfully of your position on this, I just want to say that throughout the process, we had talked about the state imposing it onto the MPO, and this has only been a wrinkle that has come up quite recently. And I guess I would argue I'm not convinced that that is an insurmountable obstacle to come up with a heavy light split for the metro area. I mean, I know that it is a long, complicated thing to do in the state, but we do it, and we come up with it, and we let it last for 2 years. And I just believe that we could, as part of this package, I don't find it insurmountable to come up with such a proposal for the metro area.
My only comment to that is I think you're correct. The difference is now you'll face probably another referral in this because you have one tax at 6535 in the metro area, and then you have the other tax, the statewide gas tax, which is 6535 across the rest of the state. Mm.
I'm not sure I get the conflict there. If it's 6535.
You have two different taxes. Mm-hmm. We're talking about congestion relief here. We're talking excise versus local imposed. And then on top of that, you're also talking, we talked on Monday night, where you have a flat gas tax, which is now 6535 also.
Keep in mind, for a trucking firm, they would have to double track their mileage. They'd have to track how much they did inside and then how much they did in the rest of the state.
Okay.
And it would add a pretty heavy complexity to what they have to do.
Yep.
Not undoable, but adding lots of complexity. Representative McLean.
Okay, well, I always appreciate Senator Boquist's thorough, you know, review of everything. But there are as many pros to impose as there are cons to impose, and there's many, you know, giving authority on a limited basis, there's pros and cons there too. But to this trucking issue, we have a new wage in the, you know, in this state, and there are tiers, and they do have to keep track of who works where, and they do have to keep track who goes where, and, you know, and so these are things that have not been done before. So I think it's important for us to get beyond all the possibilities in the world as far as referrals and, you know, get on to at least, you know, what the main message was here, which was we want to try and keep a congestion package together, and that we, you know, we have the opportunity to talk about that as we look at the actual bill being written. But I don't think anything that we're talking about here on referrals has anything to do with necessarily changes to what we've asked them to write up.
That's okay. Get off.
So I just wonder if there has been, then I've missed something. I didn't think I had.
Missed anything.
Okay.
We're answering questions here.
Okay. Anything on this? Well, the one thing that I would note, you know, this is all new turf to us. This is not new turf across the country. Every major city is considering something, is doing something like this or has done this. And I think the discussion when Seattle was talking about doing congestion pricing and that, the absolute polling showed that it absolutely wouldn't work. Nobody would like it, and it's working just fine. You know, you've got this system in the nation's capital. You've got it in Florida. You got it in Texas. You got it in Denver. You got it in Southern California in a number of places. And frankly, it's working in those places. So there's a question of do we want to do this? But it's not a question of is it feasible. And the reality is, if we, as Senator Boquist has said, if we don't do something like this, we're not going to address the congestion problem in Portland. And the reality is, with the growth that's happening up there, if we don't do something in 10 years, it's going to be faster to walk on top of the cars on I-5 than try and drive them.
So,
Senator Taylor?
No, I just wanted to thank you. I just wanted to get a better understanding of where the idea of, I'm concerned about, obviously, I think we all are concerned about things going to the ballot. And so this is a very, you know, touchy calculus, shall we say, of how all of this works. And I was just wondering if you could share more about how this came to...
It works.
I was not aware how this came to be. Was it just within your work group, or did
no,
you...
This is a work group.
No, this is...
Let me go back so everybody remembers to the previous time when we talked, and we actually made the full presentation.
Yeah, no, I remember, yeah.
So what transpired is we started looking at congestion relief, freight mobility, so on and so forth, and actually the, for a better word, the group of governments from Portland came in and said, hey, we are discussing this. Would you be interested in entertaining us paying half of the cost and you paying half the cost? And what mechanisms could we find together that would come up with the funding side for their side and the funding side for our side? So actually, we didn't come up with it at all. It was actually brought to the legislature, brought to our work group, and they made a presentation to us and said, here's some options that are out there. And from there, what we did is started working through between the constitutional issues and cost shares and how you could use the money, what are the various mechanisms that you can utilize to come up with.
Can I just one follow-up? Thank you, Senator Beyer. So just will you be the devil's advocate and tell us what the worst-case scenario would end up looking like? Who would be the ultimate losers of this system? Can you just share for us?
Well, actually, the losers of this is the entire state, because if we do nothing, that's the first thing. Nothing, you get nothing, no changes in Portland area. And my trucks from my district have to go through Portland now at the rate of 30,000 a year. So you do nothing. The worst case, I suppose, ballot scenario, which is what you're talking about, is that you could be facing the local government, like the new special district could face a referral of it to their ballot saying they don't want to pay for it. We could face a referral from a whole host of organizations saying no one wants to pay for a gas tax. And we could face a challenge in the court saying, is the excise tax go inside the highway fund or should go outside of the highway fund? That is no different whatsoever than we faced in the last time we did a transportation package, because all of that came true. Okay, the last time we did this, there was challenges in court, there was an attempt to do a referral that failed, and we went through this entire scenario. So the worst case scenario, unfortunately, is normal legislative business. And it's not pretty. The question is do we do nothing, which is the fundamental issue, or do we try to do something and go from there? And I think, you know, I would say from the work group members and ask the other three of them are there, that we, at least in the congestion price, or congestion piece, is as we looked at the governor's task force on finance and what options are there, we looked at the governor's panel, we went through all the possible options that are out there, and unfortunately, most of them have worse referrals and worse legal challenges than this one. So if you want my professional deal, this is the best of the worst choices we have if we want to get rid of congestion.
The point for us to keep in mind is that these project costs, while they may be off a little bit, these are real cost. They're not government costs. That's the cost of doing the projects. And the question is, so we don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. The people of Oregon don't have to. But you can't solve the congestion problem without doing this kind of thing. And the same thing applies to preservation and maintenance. You don't have to fix the road, but pretty soon you won't have anything to drive on. And you can't change the dollar amounts. They'll only get more. All you can change is who pays for it. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair.
Senator, of course, I'm just curious about the truck fleets that are stationed. Well, for example, I'll say you have a fleet of 100 trucks that are stationed out of Salvi Island. 5% of their time that they move across the state routes is in Portland. The remainder of that time is throughout the entire state or across the nation. How does that play out for them for what their share is then to pay?
If you use a privilege tax, it's based on the privilege tax is based on the purchase of the new vehicles that are there. So if they purchase the new vehicles there locally, right, and they purchase them here in Oregon, the privilege tax would apply to them. We sort of believe right now that if you took all of the Portland area and you just use an excise tax, it's about an 80-20 split. Trucking companies would pay about 20% of the cost because the trucks are more expensive. And then the smaller vehicles would pay about 80%. Here's the problem. If it's determined to be in the Constitution, and this goes back to Representative Smith Warmer's question, it gets much more complex because, as you pointed out, you have this trucking company, and we just say you have 6 trucking companies in Portland with 100 trucks, hypothetically, and you have X amount of cars. To get to the 65-35, those number of trucking companies have to pick up that percentage now. Mm-hmm. And so it would be astronomically expensive for those inside that excise or inside that taxing zone for the local government. Presently, if you use a gas tax, it's 65-35. If the excise tax is statewide, it would be 65-35, which is really nothing more than applying. The excise 1% excise tax really equals statewide 2 cents in gas. That's really what it is. It's about 2.5 cents in gas. But the local government, if the local metro area and special districts is created here, when it is taxed, if that is decided to be in the Constitution, your exact problem that you point out will become a big issue because you'll have a small amount of trucking companies in this geographic area. Now they're going to have to pay this proportional share. And so they would pay more. And that's the problem with the excise tax is, or excuse me, that's the problem with the local application of a gas tax and a registration tax that was Senator Taylor was talking about. And so to balance that and try and keep it, some sort of fair share is the proposal that's been put up, and come out. None of these are perfect.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to return to the question about why in the world are we engaged in such a complex approach to these problems. And I just want to draw everyone's attention back to last week where we went over what the gas tax would raise. And if we adopt the numbers that we were talking about, 6 cents plus two and two for 14, the amount that we raise plus the registration fees increase is still over that long 10-year period of time inadequate to take care of the type of problems we're now talking about in Portland. And I was tempted to ask the director, if we don't do this, when do we have to replace the Rose Quarter anyway, because it's going to fall down, because it's too old? And because one of the things we're doing, it's not just congestion, really. We're trying to find the source of the money to fix the things that have to be fixed. And the gas tax by itself is inadequate. What ends up happening is you have the entire state acting as a weight, a drag on the ability to raise the gas tax enough to fund Portland's difficulties. We knew this in the Gang of Eight, and that's why it was suggested. John Davis, Representative Davis, suggested it, a 2 cent increase in Metro, which we then would have targeted back in those discussions 2 years ago on Metro in that area. That idea has now evolved into what was just presented. We know we have to find the money in the spaces where the people are using these improvements, and that's why this has been suggested. It would be great if we could say, oh, great, let's just have the entire state, we'll just raise the gas tax, whatever. 31 cents, I think, is what it would take just to pay for maintenance. That's not going to happen. We have a much discussion about 6 cents and how to get it done correctly, because the people of Oregon are very aware of these discussions. So that's why if there's some other means of doing this, we need to hear them. But I have confidence that over the last 3.5 months, many, many alternatives have been discussed, and this is certainly one that fits a lot of the parameters and still has a lot of challenges.
I think it's a really good partnership across the state, because the primary beneficiary are people who live in the metro area who have to bear the congestion all the time. But there's also benefits to the rest of the state, and that's why there's a partnership.
I promise I will be brief, and then I will let the senator move on. I just want to go back again to, I thought Representative Smith pointed it out well, that indeed the whole state said Portland congestion is the biggest problem. It is a big thing. And number two, as far as the 65-35 split, would that be hard and a harder hit on those metro areas? Yes, and we're asking the metro area taxpayers to pay more too. So I would argue that in and of itself is not a good enough reason not to figure out the math on that other split. I'm not sure that outweighs the multiplying of the referral possibility factor.
Moving on.
Okay, moving on.
Is there anything else on this before Senator Boquist moves on? Moving on.
Just one. It's a procedural question. Last time we marched through a list and we kind of gave thumbs up, thumbs down conceptually to have the drafters do stuff. At the end of this, are there going to be consensus questions to see if we move ahead with drafting? Or
I've led you through a bunch of them already.
Okay, that may be a little too cute by half for some of us that are kind of slow.
When you finish up, we will go through the questions. You can ask them one at a time.
I think the very first thing that we talked about, just to recap here, because I'm looking at the clock too, so finishing up is coming quicker. The very first thing we went through, if you remember, is we talked about were we in agreement that these... That we were going to approach these big three projects up in the metro area. That was the very first thing. Are they the big three projects, which is really these list of projects right here? We walk through that, look for feedback.
Does anybody disagree with that?
Okay.
I don't know. And I don't mean that facetiously. To me, it seems logical, but I would rely on our metro folks to tell us where is the biggest.
Well, keep in mind, these are the projects that came. These are the projects that came by the the civic leaders in metro said, this is what you need to do.
Then I'm
this
good.
Is what
I just
came
didn't.
From the freight group.
And recall, colleagues, all we're doing is drafting four corners. We're not agreeing we're going to vote on this. We're just agreeing this is what we're going to draft and go forward with. We don't, as Representative Smith Warner pointed out, we're going to have differences of opinion as we get farther along. What we're trying to do is we're going to get this on four pieces of paper here.
Okay.
The next thing that we talked about, if you didn't know, is we talked about some of these projects would be cash flowed and that we would utilize the funding sources that we have. We walked through the project list and the timeline that we agreed that these are going to be set on a timeline that's out there so that we have that information. In addition to that, we talked about that we were going to have at least drafted, and are we going to sort of agree that we're going to see what it looks like to do congestion pricing and what it looks to do pre-construction tolling, and what does that language look like as we go forward? I'm looking for any naysayers here. Again, we're talking about drafting as long as we're on there.
Let's ask, does anybody have a problem with that? Strong objections?
I can see the facial expressions here, right?
Huh? With what?
With what?
He went over about 12 issues, so I kind of agree with that. Maybe 15. So I think...
We started out with the projects. People, we had agreement, put those in. The assumption is that those would be bonded, except for the smaller ones that would be cash flowed. Any problem with that? Then I think that... Did I miss something?
Nope.
Have we asked the group yet where they are on the excise tax?
We're just getting there.
Why don't we have him back up to where he started flipping through the slides and have him ask us? Let's do that way. I mean, I'm pretty much okay with all this, but I just want to make sure this group is. So let's just make sure people aren't sitting quietly saying, no, we really don't agree. So
right. See, I have the advantage of you can sit there quietly. I get to see everybody's facial expression and nod like this as we go across there.
They're all nodding?
That's right. See, I'm well ahead of you here, okay? See, Representative Bitch, you want them all to, you know, do like a visual single. I can tell you the tape will show you people are going, nodding yes. Or turning their head no.
Hold on, I have a question. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. So when Senator Johnson was holding up the sheet about the time frame, the Gantt chart with the time frame here, I mean, I don't know. I'd like to, at least for myself, I want to make certain that we're talking a little bit more about that. Just about the time frame for the projects. It's 10 years. And
I think to the extent,
absolutely.
Is when we looked at them, that's what ODOT said. When you look at the EISs and the building, that's when they fit. From a professional engineering perspective, that's the doable schedule.
And when we made the original presentation, if you all recall, this sheet you have all had at least. I have my staff has photocopied this at least five times and put it before you in these committee hearings. This exact same worksheet right here. If you look at it, just so if you have it in front of you, just to answer the question, there in the first column, which is it's literally this sheet right here. In the first year, you have a series of active traffic management projects, which is designed for the public to see that we're actually doing things quickly and that we're moving out and we're going to have solutions. In addition to that, then you see in year three is you have I-205 Abernathy Bridge and I-205 Stafford widening that was placed in there, if you recall, because the engineering, we're prepared in 2 years to actually start executing this project. Even though Rose Quarter is the number one project, you'll see it doesn't start till year five. That has to do with the environmental impacts, the design work, and all of the rest of that. It can't start any earlier than year five. However, we did, in fact, ask ODOT, and I'll look for the nod from the director, to try and figure out how to push that up by 6 months or so.
I think that's right, Senator. And to Senator Johnson's earlier question, we talked about procurement methodologies. Might that squeeze the timeline of delivery down when you start talking and moving beyond the design bid build process, design build, to other alternative procurement methodologies? So we've tried to look at all scenarios.
And then if you look at 217, because 217 was farther down in the priority list, Senator Johnson, if you look right down here, this line across here, the reason it's pushed out over a six-year period is, once again, is because of the utilization of state resources up in here. When I mean state resources, contractors, design engineers, ODOT's capability, local government, all of the licensing and the permitting, is that this is the one that can slide this way. And if you'll note on that sheet, what we've talked about is on I-205, that's this section right up here, even though they start simultaneously, if it turns out it's an engineering nightmare and we have to start to delay, that project would be sliding. It says in the footnotes, you'll see right down there, that project would slide out and become sequential. Instead of doing them simultaneously, both the bridge and the toll or and the lane widening simultaneously, we would sequence them to actually make more capacity to ensure that project, the number one, begins in year five. And that's where the timeline came up. And what we did in our work group, and the colleagues are here, to come up with the timeline is actually had the engineering companies in, had the contractors in, had everybody in, and walked through each of these and had forced each of them to have forced fun in the committee or the work group and say, okay, this is this, we can do this, here's the pitfalls, here's the risks that you assume to do that. And then, of course, if you recall, we made a presentation of three different courses of action. We had three separate timelines in the original presentation back in March. Boy, time's running up here. And that's how we came up with the existing one that's in front of you right now. And that's what we're trying to do and say we write that into the draft of the bill so we have that going forward.
Senator Johnson.
Senator Boquist has really touched on the point I was going to make. While this is new to some of you, I think our colleagues would attest to the fact that our work group was standing room only every time it met. And it had the Metro partners, the ODOT professional staff, all of the elements that Senator Boquist just went through. So this wasn't just made up whole cloth for the purpose of tonight's presentation. There was actually some very significant thought, including the major contractors saying, will you have adequate workforce? Will you have adequate raw materials? So we discussed this at length.
Okay.
Okay.
Moving on.
Okay, we're going to go on.
Anybody have a problem with the schedule? Okay.
Okay. The new vehicle dealer privilege tax that's up here, I just want to walk through this very quickly, you know, for drafting purposes. We talked about that. This is the state's, this is how the state would utilize to pay its 50% share of the metro area projects initially and then future projects going forward that are out there. As I pointed before, we had the discussion on the board. Presently, according to legal counsel, it is not subject to Article 9. And as Senator Taylor pointed out, and as Representative Benz pointed out, we will probably be tested on that simply because nobody knows. It's not been to the Supreme Court. And to make that more cost-effective and more efficient, if it's a friendly lawsuit, not that I've ever had a friendly lawsuit against me, all of them, they claimed they were, okay, that is a immediate direct route to the Supreme Court, which is up here and identifies that. The other issue that is there is this is if it's outside of the highway fund, you have to put very tight statutory. Remember, we talked about this last Monday, is because you don't want someone in the joint ways and means process to go take your money, notwithstanding, and put it somewhere else. And that is an important mechanism in this. But we also identified on Monday night that this is a possible source, if it's outside of Article 9, for Connect Oregon projects that are related to transportation and highway offset. When we talked briefly about highway offset, what we're talking about here is that a small portion of this fund might be possible to use, for example, for a multimodal facility to get trucks and containers off the highway. Yep. So that we have more space on the highway for cars and commuters. That's the sort of project and the language that we've asked them to try and draft up to give us a very tight opportunity. That is problematic, and of course to keep in mind, and this is a risk for Senator Taylor, as she pointed out, is if it turns out, and the reason we need to go to the Supreme Court and have it written in the law, we do this all the time for those who aren't familiar with this, so that there's an immediate determination, is that if it's found to be inside the highway fund, we don't want to go spend $25 million on a multimodal facility that wouldn't qualify normally for highway fund dollars. And so this is all timelined in the front. Senator Johnson has a question. A
couple of things. Before we pass on this and move forward, the definition of the Carbon Relief Fund is very important and who will be the decision makers. The next point for me is I am not enthusiastic about having the aggregate tax piece move forward into drafting. And last but not least, we talked a lot about 1%, and now suddenly 2% shows up. And at some point this package is going to get so astronomically big, I would make a case for 1%.
Okay, 1%. And no aggregate tax.
Questions?
1%.
Yeah. 100% advance.
Here, Mr. Chair, the second last bullet point is a big deal, and I think I would be supportive of the out-of-state user fee just to protect in-state folks from the possibility of folks all rushing out of state to buy cars.
Okay.
Explain that.
Okay, this is when you normally, when you establish a privilege tax in-state, many, many times you identify a user fee so that you don't have leakage. And that's what Representative Bentz is talking about. And how that works, and I want to point this out because it's important, is that the tax is collected through the Department of Revenue if it's an excise tax. You would receive, if you went to a dealer, they would pay the tax. It's fairly easy in the computerized world, even with legacy systems, for ODOT to recognize that that tax was paid. The problem comes in is if someone comes into the state and they have not paid that excise tax, you have a user fee. Now, the number of entities that would pay a user fee is sort of indeterminate. The reason we've even talked about an excise tax is that due to taxation in our neighboring states, okay, putting a 1% or 2%, 10 years from now in place, the competitiveness of our sales in state still remains an advantage. The problem with doing the user fee, that everybody understands, is the amount of computer technology and stuff for now ODOT has to program their computers, identify it, go for the work to identify the small amount that they come in. The question we don't know right now, because it's a lot of analytical data, is would there be enough, quote, user fees from out-of-state purchases coming into the state of Oregon to merit the expense of actually doing it? We've talked about this, and yes. If you want to just comment briefly, because you guys are doing...
I really can't add anything other than we're looking at it, trying to determine what the numbers are and is it worth the cost.
So to be real clear on that, I think you did, but if we have it on new cars and you chose to go across into Vancouver to buy a car to evade that 1%, there's an existing system in place through the interstate agreements through DMVs that they would, if you're going to license it in Oregon, they would collect at point of sale in Vancouver an equivalent amount of money and remit it to Oregon, less any tax they paid in Washington State.
Yeah, and the issue there is that for that user fee piece, because it's so small, does your administrative cost overwhelm the cost of, sort of like this, the issue of bicycle registration. We've had this discussion. That's a good analogy. It costs too much to register bicycles every year, so therefore it's not efficient to do it. It's the same question we have in terms of the user fee, because once again, and we'll just use a real world example, if it's a loss leader on a Sunday afternoon and you're reading the Oregonian in Portland and suddenly you see that Bob's new car dealership in Camas has a loss leader in which they're selling a car that's really dirt cheap and you go buy it, that's the situation. Because normally, if you have to remember, what we talked about is the excise fee. The excise tax is trying to be designed so that we are much lower than the cost of doing business in the state of Washington, California, Idaho, and Nevada. Yep. But it is an important part to be able to identify that in terms of any leakage that's out there.
Representative Smith-Warner and Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Senator. I know I had talked to Senator Boquist about this in the past, and I'm not sure how this fits into that. What we were just talking about. Like, for example, in Virginia, they have a personal property tax. And so it's collected, they do it once a year on whatever your, car, boat, et cetera. And there was that thought that, we could do it so that we can take advantage of some of our in-migration. And when you register that car here, you can do some version of that there. I do want to throw out, though, just on this front, before we move, my comment on this general slide is I got to say that the Cray Cray Fund, Congestion Relief and Carbon Relief, or whatever the other C are, Congestion Relief and Carbon Reduction, sorry. I just want to throw out a little notice that it's, to me, carbon reduction, if a fund about carbon reduction, but we can't use it for many other things that would reduce carbon reduction, whether it's incentivizing electric cars, whatever it is. I just want on the record that seems like a very narrow definition of things that you can use it on when you are in a fund that is called, that has carbon reduction in its name.
And I just want the record that the person who actually dreamed up this idea and worded was in my work group.
Well, I called it cray-cray because I like the acronym.
Okay, you're on the record. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to point out that the reason for the user fee is to protect in Oregon dealers. I just want to use Ontario as an example because Idaho is only 100 yards away, and it's just as easy. Well, actually, we don't have that huge traffic blockage problem the CRC presents to those that might want to go buy a car in Vancouver. It's pretty simple to drive into Idaho. And so the point is, when you get to Idaho, you don't pay a sales tax if you're from Oregon. So this is a protection for folks who are trying to do business in this state. Then I could go on. There are other reasons, but that's probably adequate.
That's a good point.
I just want for the record that, you know, I have, since I've been to Ontario, there's no car dealership 100 yards across the river. But he's correct.
50 miles.
Thank you. I don't believe this. Maybe I was sleeping. I want you just to know my head didn't nod a lot when we talked about just 1%. So the question I have, so we're drafting the bill, and that's okay, and I'm drafted with 1%. But at that point, will we get to talk about what that buys us versus having to have more? I'm concerned that if we say going in that's what it is, we can't buy this whole package if the revenue isn't there. So I'm just wanting to make sure that opportunity will still be there.
There's always opportunities.
Okay.
Yes.
Other questions?
Moving on.
Okay, to the question that was raised, because we're at 7:05 and we're going to end momentarily here, is that the Congestion Relief and Carbon Reduction Fund, Cray Cray, which one of my committee members, not to be mentioned, but to my left, your right, came up with that name, and now it's, you know, what's a different
acronym.
Definition of it?
Just the acronym.
Terrible. There's two slides, and you have in front of you, because Senator Johnson asked very specifically, what are the issues that are inside, and what is the verbiage, and what is the oversight for a fund like this to be utilized? And the takeaway for this evening is it says theoretical construct, congestion relief and carbon reduction fund. You can take that back, and when you go to the Beer Crafters event that's still probably going on, take this with you in your pocket and actually read through it, because the answers to the questions that Senator Johnson raised is, you know, how do you fence this? How do you do the right verbiage for it? What is the process for future funding through this mechanism? And that's all something that we'll end up taking up 2 days from now. And I do not plan, please bring your paperwork back, I don't plan to use my account anymore to continue to make photocopies for all of you. So please bring your paperwork back from tonight on Wednesday evening.
Let me ask one question, because a couple people raised the concern about the aggregate portion as a backup. The way that we have discussed that is that the 1% is the way, but an aggregate may be a backup for Connect Oregon projects. And the discussion that was there would be, it would only be on infrastructure, transportation infrastructure projects only there, and the amount went from 30 cents a metric ton to a dollar. Some of you objected. Should that not be included in the drafting for later decision, or be included?
Out.
Out. I'm getting a whole lot of outs on this side.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, I was involved in that discussion. I've never been a real fan of that.
Did you nod your head during the discussion?
On behalf of our absent co-chair, I would like to be 2 yes votes.
Okay, I'm going to do the, just for saving time here, who wants it in?
One. And one for Caddy.
One, two, three, four. Who wants it out? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Okay, got it.
Okay, with that, Mr. Chair, Wednesday evening.
Thank you all. Good questions tonight. We may be optimistic in thinking we'll finish this in one more meeting, but we're going to try.
I was. That's why I wanted to take the record.
We're adjourned. We're adjourned.